The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcaster. I'm here with wine writer, wine blogger, Maroki Tong. I just mispronounced blogger. That's a new one for me. Maroki, thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure for you, you know, for you to have me on your podcast. I am glad that I am considered interesting enough.
Oh, absolutely you are. I love the stuff you do with Andre Perreault. We'll talk about that. The podcast, the radio, and just everything you do with him on Instagram. But the first question I wrote is probably one you've never been asked before. Are you concerned that you're going to get lost in the giant sea of Chinese Canadian wine blockers that have glutted the market?
This seems like some weird like side joke about immigration or something.
Well, no, just in doing all my research on you, it's true that there aren't many people. There aren't a lot of female Chinese Canadian wine bloggers. So I decided to go the other way. Oh, are you now going to be lost in a sea of everyone? But you are very you have a very unique voice in this industry, don't you?
Sometimes, you know, when you are the only voice in rather than being lost in the sea of the same, like rather than being lost in a sea of other Chinese wine bloggers, it's almost like I'm just lost in the sea.
Right.
That it's hard to have a particular perspective on something, have it heard because it a lot of times it might not be seen as valid or seen as respectable or seen as too weird. So it's almost like it kind of discredits you. So you almost have to just play the same playing field for a while.
See, I always like what you do out there because you come from this place of genuine enthusiasm, which I think is very attractive for people that are getting into wine because they probably share a lot of the same emotions that you are. And also just someone who works their ass off in it. Like in the end, when I started just seeing what you did and the stuff you did with Andre, that was my two things. I'm like, okay, this person's got incredible work ethic and incredible enthusiasm from it. And from that is going to come knowledge and perspective. So I always appreciate just the way you present yourself and in terms of your wine knowledge.
I'm glad that you say that. Actually, that's really good validation for me because obviously this is the first time we're meeting in person. We've had some interaction online, but it's not like we have regular conversation.
Yeah.
So you're getting this particular impression of me just from witnessing my work.
Correct.
And that's really validating for me to hear because sometimes you just do the work and you put things out in the void and you hope that it's resonating with people. But I don't know, right? Mm-hmm. If people don't comment or if people don't message me and say, I like this about what you did or I didn't like this about what you did, the only validation you have is whether people are engaging with you, right? And sometimes lack of engagement is the most painful thing because you're like, no one cares. No one cares about what I have to say. What's the point? Why would I spend, you know, why would I lose sleep over something when no one actually cares? So I'm glad that you can see some of those things that I'm offering value for one.
Yeah.
But also that you sense that I'm working hard for it and that I'm not just sleeping on the job, I guess, so to say.
No, you can't. I mean, there's part of it is there's so much to learn about wine and there's so much out there and just trying to get your head around it. And the moment you do, then suddenly Italy's got a new grape and you're like, what grape is that? and then you're behind on. Also, I mean, you know, you and Andre work really well together. And I mean, Andre's a damn good when it comes to wine, making wine, talking about it, reporting on it. And the fact that he's working with you is also a reflection as well. Let's start from the beginning. How did you first get started in the wine blogging world?
Wine blogging or just wine?
I guess just wine. I shouldn't say blogging. Even though blogging is writing, and writing is so important and so hard. Maybe just wine social media, because obviously the Instagram account 9 ounces, please. And how do you decide to get started in the world of wine?
So before even I got started in, you know, wine social media, wine blogging, and at this point I would say it's approaching 4 years. It was the pandemic project, so I'll get to that in just a second. But I've been passionate about wine for almost 20 years. It's just something I got. Like one day I decided, like a lot of my things, I'm really interested in this now. I will approach it from a maximalist perspective where I'm going to taste everything, try everything, ask people questions, just get super, super deep into it.
So then let's pause there and go to that moment before we get to social media and all the work you're doing. Where did that moment come from? Where was that collection of moments? Where did they come from?
I think I've always been passionate about learning, for one. And I've always been passionate about flavors, taste, exploration, adventure, right? So before wine, there was tea. After tea, there was scotch, then food, and then tasting food of different cultures. It's something that I've always prioritized, even when I was like the brokest student on planet Earth, right? I remember I would scrimp and scrounge my dollars and literally go into fine dining restaurants with sweatshirts with holes in them. Mm-hmm. I'm really bad with dress codes and just being like, I'm going to come and eat here now, because that's what I would want to do. I remember when I would backpack across countries, I would spend pennies just eating maybe a handful of nuts all day. I remember once, even, I swear to God, I literally walked around with like a jar of coconut oil because it was so dense in calories, and would eat that all day just so I could save enough money to go eat a really cool dinner
right
somewhere. That was kind of something that's always been a part of me. You know, when I got into alcoholic beverages, wine was not top, right? When you are a starving student, you're not drinking the fine wine most of the time. You're, you know, or maybe you didn't even understand that they're like the different price points of wine. And I also turned 19 in Northern Ireland, so wine wasn't the culture, right? It was either, right, it was beer or hard liquor. All that is to say, one day I remember saying to myself, today I am going to get into wine. I think it was in my last year of university. I distinctly remember sitting in my bedroom with a glass of yellowtail, right? Swirling this glass, and I'm thinking to myself, this is dumb. I'm like sitting in a room with a white carpet swirling this red wine and sniffing it and thinking, what does this smell like? And in that moment, even understanding the disconnect of, wow, things smell familiar, but I can't put my finger on it, and recognizing how when you don't have a visual, when you don't have a visual element involved, or we don't have taste, how you actually lose things. You know how in like competition shows, like Top Chef, how they blindfold people and they taste things and taste things wrong. I'm like, wow, there really is that disconnect that happens, and just learning. So I just I you know, dug the rabbit hole,
yep,
and then dove headfirst into it. Right, I started buying different wines, started tasting different things. I started asking, you know, hounding sommeliers in restaurants, right? I'd read these things and be like, what is this? Why is it this note? Why is this? I'm sure I really drove some, you know, sommeliers or servers in restaurants crazy when I was 19, 20, because I just asked every question I could ask, because this is the only way I could learn. And then, you know, spent years, you know, visiting wineries, got into Ontario wines, developed a huge passion for that. Whole other story that I won't get into right now as we talk about this particular trajectory of my journey. But years and years later, you know, at this time I was a working actor, I was in the performing arts, I was in entertainment, trying to make a go out of that. And I always loftily thought to myself, oh, it would be so nice if one day I could combine these joys together, right? Like I could have a wine show, or I could talk about food and drink. You see the food and drink travel shows, you watch Food Network. It never happened, because obviously it's very, very difficult to make it in that kind of industry. And
yeah,
there's so many directions you could be pulled in at any given point. I never ended up there. And then at this point, I took some pivots in my career. I had some, you know, major injuries that took me out of work, and I ended up, you know, taking a lot of time, and I ended up getting, I guess, like a glimpse of my mortality because of the injuries I sustained, and went back to school and did my MBA. And I think around the time I finished my MBA, I thought, ooh, maybe I can now do something in wine business. And a lot of the jobs I looked for talked about needing a minimum of WSET. And I remember looking up a WSET and going, well, I'm so broke right now. Like at this point, I'm just ending my, I'm looking at pivoting away from acting. I'm so poor. I have to spend more money and more time. Fast forward to the pandemic, you know, like a lot of people probably had used the pandemic as a lot of reflection time to figure out, what is it we truly want in life?
Right.
And I thought to myself, well, Maroki, you still have this passion. You've done nothing with the passion other than, you know, talking off your family and friends' ears whenever they bring a wine to a party, probably more than they ever needed to hear about that particular bottle of wine. Why don't you start blogging about it? Worst case scenario, no one will ever read what you wrote.
Yeah.
Best case scenario, you get a chance to maybe bring this dream of yours to life. And the lowest barrier of entry was a place like Instagram. And I just started blogging, and I guess people liked what I wrote.
There's a lot to go from that. One, like we have very similar, there is a lot of similarities between you and I. Once you got into wine, you're like, that's it. I'm going hardcore. It's not half-ass. It's, you're going to, as you said, you're going to dive fully in. Also, it makes sense. You're into tea or scotch or food or travel. That is such a natural you know, than to entry into wine. But also what you said there, and I've talked about it in a past podcast, the importance of Yellowtail and the importance of a lot of more inexpensive entry-level wines from whatever producer from one country. And I think I used to make the mistake, I don't anymore, where sometimes I would shit on these wines. And I remember one day going, no. There's a lot of people that are now sommeliers, master sommeliers, teaching courses at WSET, working in high-end restaurants. And they were a teenager. They were in their early 20s. And that was the first wine. And then they enjoyed that wine. And eventually they moved on to something else, something else, something else. But it does speak to the importance of wines like that to sort of open the door for people.
Absolutely. And I think we also have to sometimes, especially us as wine nerds or wine experts or sommeliers, we have to remember that a lot of people aren't like us. And a lot of people probably don't want to be spending their discretionary income on $100 wines. The majority of the populace, I think I saw a stat some time ago that said 75% of the world spend less than $10 on a bottle of wine. Now, obviously, this incorporates places like Europe where buying an affordable wine that's reasonably good is a lot more accessible than a place like Ontario. So obviously, those averages different. And then they said of that remaining 25%, another 70% doesn't spend more than 15%. I'm trying to remind myself of this all the time because a lot of my friends who come to me outside of wine who ask me for recommendations, I often am capped at the $20 range. And I'm regularly actually trying to keep myself humble. I actually go back and taste wines that I used to buy in, you know, in the $10 ranges and just see where they're at. Seeing where my palate is at, mm-hmm. seeing where they're at, and just knowing that those things are out there. And even from an economical standpoint, I know a lot of us, you know, have like a passion for supporting small business. You know, wine as an industry is really, really tough. And obviously you hear a lot of stories about small, you know, family run wineries and small wineries struggling against the giant conglomerate winery. And they kind of say like, they are the ones like stopping us. But I think first of all, there's different demographics that these wines serve, right? For one. And sometimes people need a gateway. You need them to have the gateway and bring them up.
Yes.
I think the other thing is that we these things aren't black and white. So I know, I think it's EJ Gallo. They just opened up a facility around the Finger Lakes area sometime 2 years ago, I want to say, a year and a half, 2 years ago. And that's a budding wine region, a lot of small family run wineries there. And I remember speaking to one of the assistant winemakers, and you know, they were telling me about it, and I was expecting them to kind of be like, ugh, like, how dare they come? And they said, we're really excited. And I said, well, why are you really excited? Because this is not the response I expected from you. And they said, they're going to create a lot of jobs. They're going to really, you know, give a lot of opportunities to people who want to work in wine, winemakers. It's going to raise the economy of the region. More people are going to want to come here. And as a result, we can actually share our wines with people when they come here. So I think it's always worth examining the different perspectives of, you know, what's the, you know, the difference between small wineries and large brands.
Yeah, I mean, the large brands are important. And I think also for us in the wine industry, it's always easy to recommend, oh, you need a Syrah? Well, here's a $295 Gugel Cote Roti. That's easy. But then it's, can you get me a good $20 one? By the way, Creekside, their entry-level Syrah will get you the cracked pepper and the blue fruit for $16.95.
I know.
Yeah, it's a great one. I love that.
I know,
that.
It's
I love
killer.
I actually said on one of my pods, but I think it's one of my wines of the year, was the Creekside entry-level, just because it's so good. But the point is, it's so important, and it's a skill that's required is being able to find wines that'll satisfy that are early 20s and less.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We'll get back into the Ontario wines in a second as well, because that's another thing is I think it's important to tell people, Ontario wines, they're more expensive, but the reason is because of the taxes, because it's handpicked, because you pay your laborers a fair wage. Like I always tell everyone, that Ontario wine you're drinking, if that's $32, the profit margin is incredibly slim. And I think people sometimes need to be reminded of that.
I think it's the whole thing about, do you like supporting your local baker?
Yeah.
Right? And when you're supporting your local baker, your local coffee shop, you might be paying a slight premium on it, but it's because you care about those particular values. And when it comes to buying local wine, it's the same thing. You're supporting those values. But to be honest, it's not just that. The wine is fantastic these days, right? No, we might not be able to compete in the $10 market, but we compete very well these days within the $20-ish market.
Yeah,
and agreed. Honestly, we're even seeing us improve, right? As some wineries are beginning to achieve certain scales, we're selling wines in the $12, $13 range. Actually, I even did a shout out today because Vineland has an entry-level Cab Franc that always knocks my socks off, right? It's 15, it's I think it's $12 technically right now with the part, you know, the
HST,
offers. Yeah, with the HST and the disc, you know, they have discounts all the time. We have it out there. It's just, it's pointing it out to the right, like pointing it out and pointing them in that direction as opposed to like maybe that, you know, not so great Magnum sitting over here of not so great, maybe international Canadian blend nonsense, right?
Yeah, we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
By the way, totally off topic. Do you do the thing where you see the LCBO and you'll just wander in for 2 minutes to see if there's any of the crazy markdowns or anything? Because I do that. I do that all the time.
Just 2 minutes?
Okay. I was trying to be nice. I was trying to be nice to myself. But yeah, I will all the time. I see an LCBO. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go and just all the rows to see if there's any of the wines I like or anything that's interesting. That's especially those 30% mark knockoffs for wines from less popular regions that I always love to swoop in and try.
Oh, always. I love less popular regions. I like seeing discounts. I actually really like wandering into the LCBOs around the Jewish quarter because they always need to keep a wall of kosher wines. Right. So their wines get discounted really fast.
Oh, I haven't done that.
Yeah. So strategically, I'm always like, I'm going to find some really banger deals if I stop into this LCBO because I know they have to maintain that shelf space all
right.
the time.
Right. Oh my God. That is smart. And stupid me. I just always go to the one in front in Spadina. I didn't even think about that. I got to go out and expand. Do you remember what the first couple things you wrote about?
Ooh.
And if you don't, it's okay. It's a long time ago, but you know.
I remember when I first started, my posts were a lot shorter. They got longer and longer as time went on. I think I remember some of the first ones was, it was a lot more limited. I would say my collection was a lot more limited. It was at, you know, like the first posts that came out were April. So I remember there was a lot of local wines. I was really trying to push the local, like the conversation of supporting local, buying from local wineries. So I took a lot of photos of wine hauls. Mm-hmm. I would say like there was a wine haul from Carlo. There was probably a wine haul from Meldville. There was probably a wine haul from, I remember one of my earlier posts, like in the summer when they were allowing tastings in vineyards, I think I did a bender. I went out and I visited 8 spots, breweries and wineries. And because they were like, a lot of them weren't actually even hosting, could just do drop-in. Like,
right.
Just, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just bought stuff from every winery I could. I had time to squeeze in my day and took pictures of the hauls just to say, go and do this summer. It was oftentimes, I think I blogged a lot about maybe food and wine pairings from restaurants that were doing bottle shops at the time.
Yep.
So I would say those are all my earliest topics or strange things like wine in an aluminum, not even a can, not even, like I did talk about cans too, but I think it was wine in an aluminum bottle.
Right.
Right. Just like the most like rando things.
So really a lot of the innovations that were happening because of COVID with the bottle shops and there was certainly much more of a push for drink local during COVID as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say one of the earlier topic conversations I had too was probably my very first, I would say, I'm surprised I didn't clue into this sooner. And there was a little bit of naivete, I would say, when I entered the wine industry, maybe because it was always for myself. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have to look at the ugly underbelly of the wine world in the same way that I experienced it when I was an actor or experienced it working in areas of business. But it never quite occurred to me that wine could be gatekeepy. It could be sexist. It could be racist. It could be non-inclusive. And you know, around the time I started the wine blog, obviously, as we rolled into the summer, there was the George Floyd incident that happened. Mm-hmm. And that kind of really revealed a lot of things for me in a very short period of time, the issues that exist in an industry that I loved. And it's almost like getting, you know, the Band-Aid ripped off very violently, very fast. And that was actually some of the early conversations I had, too. And I remember I approached it with a lot of nervousness. Like, I did it full gusto. That's something I talk about. I have a lot of lived experience in it growing up in, you know, a rural area just outside of Toronto. But, You know, whenever you start something, and it made me feel like I was a budding actor again. When something, when you know there's injustice and you don't know if you can speak up because you don't know if that means it will actually bar you from work.
Right.
And it really sucks that that's the case, that sometimes you need to swallow your opinion because it gets you barred from work. And it's an issue that I think continues to this day. We hear about, you know, women who have been harassed in workplaces and they haven't spoken up. It's still an ongoing issue because they think that if they speak up, they'll never get hired again. And I'm lucky that I'm in a position in my life that I don't care. I guess it's like if that's the way you are going to treat me and if that's what's going to be wrong with the industry, then something's wrong and I will continue fighting it. I'm also very fortunate in that wine is not the thing that pays my bills.
Mm-hmm.
And because it doesn't pay my bills, I have the privilege of being able to speak up.
But you're saying freedom, that it's not morality versus mortgage.
Yeah. And I know that that's not the case for a lot of other people
in
the industry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That is that's certainly an advantage. Is there any, and again, it's always hard sometimes when you ask for specifics, do you have any moments that stick out where you really got to see the ugly underbelly of the wine industry?
It's interesting because I feel like in 2021, I had a lot of key examples. Obviously, a lot of time has passed.
Yeah.
It's like small. Here's some really small examples that I've... It's funny because I didn't even notice them. Other people pointed them out for me. And it speaks a little bit to a lot of survival mechanisms. I would say like BIPOC folks, women of color, black women and stuff face that it just becomes so part of your everyday narrative or everyday living. You don't realize that it's not okay. So... one of the ones is like as when I, you know, used to go touring in Niagara or where say have you, if I don't go in and I immediately just kind of open my mouth, speak and just kind of be like, hey, how's it going? Like, I'm really interested in these wines and maybe just throw a few technical like words out.
So they know that you know that. Yeah.
They know that I know and they know I speak fluent English.
Right.
And that they will treat me because there's a lot of unconscious bias that happens when you don't speak fluently or if you speak with an accent. I see the way my mother gets treated when we're out in the public and I, you know, as opposed to the way I get treated. And so it's one of those things I have to go in and kind of establish my presence right away.
Right.
There's definitely a lot of like people who go in, they immediately assume you just want ice wine or sweet wine because they're like, oh, that's what Chinese people want, I guess, so to say. I noticed this a lot more as I started touring with other people. I did a lot of tourism solo. But when I started bringing friends with me and when I started dating my partner, Eric, and brought his parents along for wine, a lot of times they don't look at me. They won't even refer to me. They'll refer to him. They'll refer to my friends first. A lot of my friends that I brought along with me just tended to be white. And they'll say, do you notice how we had to pass the buck to you? And I actually didn't. But again, it's maybe just because I'm used to it.
Right.
I'm used to it happening. So either I need to speak up or someone needs to point out those things. I think a lot of times it's even commentary on your success or something, right? There's a lot of that around the industry and like we've seen it happen. Usually the excuse is like, we don't like influencers but a lot of times it's saying it's very sexist tinged, right? It's like, oh, it's because if a girl just puts on a cute dress and smiles, she's going to get engagement. I'm like, or it could also be because she's writing good content and that she's spending some effort to make her photos look nice. Like if you were doing an editorial for a magazine, you're not going to take a shitty photo of your glass of wine and just like with your phone and write about it. You're going to spend some effort for it. So here's someone who's treating their platform like it's high quality and high production value. It has nothing to do with the fact that she's a woman. She just happens to be a woman who's wearing a dress and smiling for a photo. And it's like, if you have issues about influencer culture, that's one thing, and I won't open that can of worms today, but that's not the same as basically saying something like, oh, because she has breasts,
right?
Or because, you know, she's doing this and she's doing that. And
low body fat doesn't mean you have low IQ when it comes to wine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that must have just pissed you off when they're looking at someone else and not you at a wine. It's like, no, I'm the one who knows the most about wine here. Like, you know, I'm the one that you need to go to first and I'm going to help my friends. That must have been frustrating.
Like I said, it was no one's ever, there's very few instances I've been really, really put on the spot, I guess, so to say, or people are so rude or so impolite where it like feels like I get super mad. I think as I just become more conscientious and aware of it, and that's just a really sad thing to behold. I think the bigger difficulty is sometimes when you are the wine industry, there is a conversation that is obviously very, very male dominant. And the thing that, and white male dominant specifically. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that wine, it's not so different than, let's say, in other industries, like business, like finance. You know, I've worked, you know, with finance clients in the past, and there, and you know, I've done due diligences for tech startups when I was doing my MBA, and there's an inherent unconscious bias and microaggression that happens in these industries where if you're an Asian woman, you're seen as quiet, you're seen as subservient, you're seen as not meant to have an opinion. There's a lot of stories of a lot of like Asian women in tech startups who basically have been told that they were thought of as the assistant, they were the founder, right? And there's just this unconscious bias that exists, and it permeates everything. And people don't think they're being racist per se, but sometimes when you just go and when you ask people where they're from, or if you even open your conversation with like ni hao, like you don't even know if they're Chinese or Japanese or whatever, right. And you're like assuming, when you do these things that you think are nice, they're not nice, and it actually diminishes who they are, diminishes their qualifications. And when someone has to correct you, like why would you assume immediately someone's an assistant as opposed to asking their opinion and asking their position per se, right? Or there's a thing that happens that, you know, most Asian women, we are physically smaller, right? We're shorter. It's, you know, it's an ancestral anthropological thing. So people literally physically look down on you. And there's, you know, we can try and say we don't do this, but there's power dynamics in height and how people treat each other due to, you know, if an Asian woman looks young, we look young, right? Like that's a very common stereotype that is out there. People all treat them a certain way, and it's hard to undo that. It's like, it's a very systemic thing. So what I'm trying to get at is when someone like me comes up, I'm very forceful. I'm quite loud. I'm not afraid to speak up.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid to be confrontational and state when things are wrong. It pisses people off. So like when you made that joke at the beginning, you know, how's it like competing against all these things? When someone like me comes up because I'm not behaving in the way that is expected of me, it can offend people's sensibilities.
Okay, yeah.
Right? It's like, I don't meet their stereotype, so I'm not playing by their rules. And how dare I not play by their rules? There's a conversation out there. There's like a dialogue out there right now in the world that's saying like, that like BIPOC folks should approach things with the audacity of a white male. Like, it's like, if you want it, you should just go and do it. If you do it, you can get it too. It's like, no, 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 it doesn't happen that way. Because we aren't white men. So if we approached it like that, and that's like literally what third wave feminism is, when you approach it that way, you're probably gonna get treated like, we're gonna get punished for it, because it's not expected of you to be behaved that way. And there's a lot of systems in place that bar people from behaving that way or punish people from behaving that way. And that's something that I've just lived with my entire life because that's how I carry myself.
Have you found there's been any pushback on any of your content because of who you are?
You know, I'm pretty fortunate. I think I've worked really hard to cultivate a community of people who share in my values. And right. The people who don't share in those values probably don't follow me, or they have unfollowed me. Maybe I just don't know. I'm very fortunate that I don't get the kind of vitriol that I've seen some of my peers get. That's not to say I don't occasionally get it, for sure. I find a lot of times, I try to be nuanced in what I say. So I try not to, you know, be like a super, I try not to be incredibly overly blunt about it, or I try not to make sweeping statements, because I recognize that there's a lot of things that are complex. And, you know, I believe that sometimes change, you can't, I get really fired up a lot of things, but I know in the grand scheme of things, you can't always fight fire with fire. If I piss off those people even more, I'm not going to get change. I need to have those conversations. I need to sometimes hear what they have to say. That's, you know, it does, but it does happen. I've had, you know, people write all sorts of things for me. I think sometimes the more difficult ones is just people who, it's almost like the harder conversations when they message you and they're like, well, I don't think I'm like this because I'm like this, this, this. And then you have to kind of go back and be like, actually, that's problematic, mm-hmm. right? And I find that that's usually the harder conversation to deal with, is a lot of times the pushback I get is more people trying to claim that they maybe aren't, or maybe they read something I wrote and they maybe felt like they identified with it and they felt the need to defend themselves. And now you're having really, really awkward conversations with them about it.
Getting back to wine.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like bouncing around all over the place on the conversation. How have your wine, your taste in wine, how's it changed? Because I find for myself now, I lean more Grenache than I ever have. You know? Huh.
Why would you say?
I think like a lot of people, you know, you start more with the big reds, then eventually you're almost a red, white, even Steven on the red side. This is the stereotype of anyone in wine. We get off a lot of the big ones. There's a little bit less Cab and there's more Pinot and Beaujolais and things like that. And then recently, just the last couple of years, maybe because like Grenache has some similarities with Nebbiolo or Pinot Noir, where there's, I guess, still some of the same similarities, but there's still this spice component that's just different. The Grenache and the licorice and the smokiness and stuff. So I found recently I've been leaning more towards South African Grenache and so much Spanish Grenache as well, that I've just noticed. Like I've noticed what brings me more joy. And recently, a lot of times the Grenache, I'm open, I'm having a sip, and I just pause. I'm like, fuck, that's good. I look at the bottle. I'm like, good for you. You know, like a dog who just rolled over. Like, oh, good for you. You know, and I found that recently over the last couple of months. And I always keep track of just how my own tastes have changed over the years. So I'm fascinated with you when you started, say, you know, during COVID or even before that, if that you lean more one way in terms of a grape or a country than it was before.
I definitely say back in the day, I think like a lot of folks, you know, where we tend to drink a little bit sweeter. And when I say sweeter, it's like you're drinking those, you know, entry-level Californian reds that are 18 grams of residual sugar, even though they're considered a dry red, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And I liked my big, you know, big buttery Chardonnays.
Nothing wrong with the big buttery Chardonnay. Okay, I'm going to give a shout out. Wenty, you're fine. We all have to have our guilty pleasure. And mine is just entry-level buttery Chardonnay. Black Box is my favorite box wine. They're Chardonnay. Every time I go to the States, that's always that becomes the house wine wherever I'm staying.
There's bottles now in the States that are labeled extra buttery.
I know.
And I'll never see them being like extra buttery, you say.
That's a little much. It's like, I love bad pizza. I don't need cheese stuffed crust pizza.
All right,
but
right.
I'm good with bad pizza. Yeah, but anyway, yeah.
But definitely a lot more New World centric. And, you know, sometimes it's also due to what's available, mm-hmm. right? And within a certain price point. I remember I got into Portuguese wines quite early in the ball game because I would say, you know, as I entered early adulthood, I guess so to say, and I was trying to look for things, I would always look for things that are like, well, how can I drink a wine that is valued at 30, but I'm only paying 10?
Right.
Right?
That would be Portuguese wine.
And so I've actually had a passion for Portuguese wines for a long time. Obviously, I drink nicer stuff now. I definitely have leaned into acids more, and obviously being an Ontario wine lover, it was interesting. I always definitely operated in those two ends of the spectrum. I would drink the Ontario wines and I liked my heavier stuff. I would say one of the bigger changes for me is I actually was never a super fan of bubbles. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone always was like, there's always a good day for champagne.
Right.
And I was always like, meh, or I could just open this red over here instead. I think it was a mixture of a lot of times acidity. I am quite sensitive to acid, so I read it quite strongly on my palate. So even though I very much appreciate a great Riesling, and, you know, we have a lot of Riesling in my home, I find that's not the easiest for me to drink. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, traditional method sparkling wine or most sparkling wines always like had that acidity, and then you add the bubbles, which always made it like extra acidic. Somewhere in the last year and a half, something awoke in me and I'm like, bubbles, 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 bubbles. So I've really been getting into bubbles recently. I'm not a seasonal drinker, but seasons affect.
Yeah, you're not a seasonal drinker, but there may be an uptick in certain styles depending on the season.
I would also say that I used to love really old wine. Mm-hmm. I definitely loved aged wine. I chased after them. It's funny. It was like always an ongoing joke between Andre and I in our Instagram lives and stuff, because we have that Instagram live called Cellarit where we talk about, we buy two bottles of wine, we taste one, we decide how long to cellar the second one.
By the way, I'm going to pause. If people want to catch this, why do we wait till the end to promote everything? Where would people go to get it?
So you can obviously go to my Instagram, 9 ounces please on Instagram. That's the number 9 forward ounces forward please. And we typically go live on the last Wednesday of every month. Typically, obviously Andre and I both have jobs outside of wine. So it sort of kind of is a little bit dependent on our schedules. And we just try and let people know as soon as we can. But yeah so we do this thing. And back in the past, I used to always be like, oh, I want to like push the envelope. I want it to be so old. I want to taste nothing but baseball glove. I want that leathery goodness. I've actually started preferring wines with a little bit more youth in them. I want it where when the primary fruit is just beginning to fall off, those tertiary notes are coming in. It's this nice tension between the two. So I would say that that's another place where my tastes have changed.
Yeah, the old wine, sometimes when I think about people like drinking really old wine, I equate it to people that want their chicken wings to be extra hot. I get mine triple suicide and all this. I'm like, are you enjoying the wing or are you, it's almost a dare. You're trying to see how far you can push the envelope and how much can you suffer and still eat the wing. And I sometimes think that with wine, like at a certain point, as you said, if it's just all leather and spice and mushroom, you know, there's got to be some, at least a little bit of fruit.
And, you know, chances are I'm going to be poured some really killer aged wine and I'm just gonna be like, nope, still dig my pure leather and fruit. I think it's a matter of just, you know, maybe one of the things is like, do we drink wine for academia or do we drink wine for pleasure?
Right.
And when I was earlier on in the journey, especially when I really started blogging and writing, I wanted to taste everything under the moon and stars because I just wanted to be explore. I remember going the same way as beer, right? You're drinking every sour, every IPA, and then at the end of it, you're like, a really good Helles. That's all I need.
Yeah.
A really good Helles. And there's a lot of complexity in a good Helles. It's not just watered down beer as people describe when they're like light beer. I'm like, no, I've tasted the Helles beers when I was in Germany and I had my mind blown. And that's the same thing. Sometimes you just need like a really good Syrah, right? Since we wanted to, you know, do a callback to Syrah, sometimes you just need a really good Syrah. It doesn't need to be the I don't know, strangest concrete fermented, then touched egg with and touched with like a mineral of this and that. I mean, winemaking isn't as weird as beer. You don't have to infuse it with a million things, but it doesn't have to be always the most experimental new thing. If it's what you like, if you like concrete because you don't necessarily, you want some texture without oak, totally get it. But it doesn't need to be done for the sake of just doing it.
Do you get intimidated with blind tastings and things like that?
Depends who's blind tasting me. Mm-hmm. Is maybe the right answer. I love it. I think it's fun.
Yeah.
I think it's fun to make mistakes. I think it's fun to feel validated when you get something. I think it can be really intimidating if you're put in a context where you're like judged for it or you're among extra peers and you know they're looking at the validity of who you are. So I would say context matters.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I've gotten intimidated by what I've been doing it in, you know, whether it's for the WSET exams or in tasting groups with people from my classes back in the day. And it's what always intimidated me is like, I don't mind if I get it wrong, but I don't want to get it loud wrong. You know, like and what I found is even at the diploma level, when we would be in class and, we'd go over something, the teacher would be like, okay, who wants to talk about this wine? And there would still be some level of sheepish, even though we all got along, we're all friends and we've all done it for years and years. There was still sometimes a level of sheepish, which I always remember. I always found that fascinating.
I think it's just that industry snobbery that hopefully will continue to dispel over the years. And making wine accessible and recognizing that wine's complex. Like there's so much freaking wine out there. Wine's complex and weird and beautiful and amazing. And maybe that's why it's okay to make a mistake. Like
yeah.
not when you see the master psalms do it, it's magic, right? It's literally magic. But there's a like, that's probably their life.
And that is.
If you're a casual wine drinker, that's not, or maybe even just like, if you're not familiar with that at the time. I remember, I think it was, I want to say it was last year's I4C or maybe the previous year, they did a blind, an 8 Chardonnay blind tasting. And I think they said, you know, you have to guess the region. And I remember that being the major one, the region. And they had 8 countries available and obviously Canada. And I think 7 out of the 8 were from Ontario or at least within Canada. But when you're given those parameters, of course, that's when your brain gets in the way too. You're like,
you're going to cheat. You're going to start going all over the world.
Yeah, you're going to start going all over the world. And mm-hmm. I remember thinking to myself, I don't even know if I've had a German Chardonnay. So how would I possibly know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think the thing is that there's such an expectation when you're in the wine industry to perform a certain way. And in a way that's, it feels a lot more absolute than some other industries sometimes. And it's because it's like, it's subjective and not subjective at the same time. Like, math is not subjective.
Yes.
Right? You're right or wrong.
Right or wrong. It's right.
Art is all subjective for the most part. Wine is like a mixture of subjectivity and not. And therefore, the creation of wine offers a lot of opportunity for deviation. So sometimes that grape variety gets completely transformed because of the oak, because of the age, because of the region. There's just a lot. And damn, you've got to be a magician to be able to taste through all of that.
And sometimes it just was transported incorrectly from Europe to North America.
Maybe it was faulted.
And it can be screwed up. Before we continue, what you poured something, which was really nice. What are we drinking here?
So we're drinking a Syrah, since we're on the topic of Syrah. Maybe that's why it like subliminally messaged just us to talk about Syrah the entire episode. We're drinking a Syrah from the Finger Lakes, actually. It's from a winery called Fulkerson Winery. They are a farm winery, and they've been farming for about 100 years in the region. They actually have an Airbnb you can rent across the street. That's how I discovered them, actually, was staying in their super, super, like 100-year-old, maybe haunted Airbnb for a wedding. And I met the rep at an event and went and visited the winery. And it's interesting because they're kind of, you know, Finger Lakes is so well known for Riesling, so well known for cool climate viticulture. You don't necessarily think of Syrah. But there's, you know, like a lot of places, the Finger Lakes has a lot of microclimates. And in this particular area, they are able to get heat on that Syrah so that it can, you know, get to that ripeness that you are looking for. And Finger Lakes is an interesting region because there's still a lot of farm winery culture they're still undoing. You know, you go to a lot of wineries, you'll see a lot of kitsch, per se. You'll see a lot of, you know, socks and tchotchkes and Christmas ornaments. But
yeah,
there's also a lot of focus on fine wines. And even the wineries that used to make, you know, I think they're called Barn Cat Reds. They're famous for the wine slushies. That's kind of their thing. They actually are trying to start creating more focus on, you know, really good viticulture and making good premium wines out there. And I think these guys are doing a bang up job.
Well, considering how much good Syrah we can make in Ontario, in Niagara, it's not a surprise that can be done in Finger Lakes. I mean, hell, there's a lot of good Pinot Noir being made in England. So, you know, areas we didn't think could do it are doing it. And
maybe took a sip. So now I'm curious to know what you're thinking of it.
Well, it's interesting. I think on first sip, I don't know if I would go Syrah, just because I'm looking for a little bit of that pepper, but the blue fruit is absolutely there on the finish. Actually, it's funny. On the first sip, I was almost thinking, would I start going over to Merlot, because I'm getting mediums all over the place, and it's a nice warm red dark fruit thing going on. It's a bit of a hug. So then my brain just starts going, you know, towards Merlot. Smooth, well-made, mediums across, nice acid on the end. The blue fruit is there. First two sips, very enjoyable, very nice. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, though, right? As you said, like, we have this expectation when we taste a certain variety.
Yeah.
And then we realize that those varieties can transform so much based on the regions you're going into. Actually, another Syrah that, I find that has changed a lot over the years is Derek Barnett's Syrah. Mm-hmm. I remember... I fell in love with Syrah in Ontario before I realized we actually didn't make as much Syrah as I thought, because in my very early Ontario days, I basically became a Derek Barnett fangirl. That's how I got into Ontario wines. I discovered Laylee.
Good person to fall in love with.
Yeah, Derek. I discovered Laylee at Hamilton Wine and Food Fest. I was volunteering there so that I could try and taste food without paying the money for it. So, you know, like I said, the what I did in my 20s to try and get myself a good bite.
But work ethic and passion. I said it off the top. You volunteering at that Hamilton thing, you know, I mean, that kind of screams it right there.
Yeah. So I, you know, I fell in love with his Syrahs, which were always beefy and meaty. And I find that his Syrahs that are making here making now are fresher and brighter than I ever remembered them being. So, you know,
yeah,
that's where you get those stylistic changes.
Yeah, this one, this is fresh and bright. If I'm going to be put into a category, this isn't the savory, beefy type.
There's still a bit of like salt on it, though. Mm-hmm. Like when I smell it, right? Like you still kind of get a little bit of that saltiness that I'm looking for in Syrah. Sometimes I have tasted some Syrahs that are a little bit too bright for me. But this one still has like a reminiscence of that savoriness that I'm seeking if I'm going to be opening a Syrah.
The promise also is I was about to do like aggressive sniffing, and that's the worst thing for a podcast. There's nothing worse on a wine podcast. And I try to edit out the slurps and all the noises that we make.
Guys, let's all experience wine in real time.
Yeah, I know. Oh, God. And then I got to go back and try to edit out some of those noises.
It's like when you're trying to taste live on camera.
Yeah.
You don't realize how long. I remember trying to do a wine video once where I wanted them to get my genuine reaction. So I'm trying to smell and taste, and all you see are these long pauses. Yeah. My brain is trying to process what I'm smelling and tasting and then formulate real words out of it, and hopefully not me just saying the same fruit over and over again, because my brain literally cannot conceptualize it at the same time I'm sniffing and tasting.
That's the worst. At least even in exams, you have time to get at what it is. When you have to do it on TV or on Instagram Live and you're just like racing it through and go, shit, did I just say raspberry for the third time? Shut the hell up on raspberry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Move on to what are the tertiary, what are the other notes going on?
My mistake is often saying the word nose or palate too much. So I'll be like, cherry on the nose, blue fruit, a hint of tobacco on the nose, and then you know, it has a weighty mouthfeel on the palate, red fruit on the palate. Yeah. And I'll just say the same because I'm like, to now I'm talking about the nose. Now I'm talking about the palate. And I'm like, Maroki, come up with another word for nose. Yeah. Like say perfume, say bouquet, say come up with synonyms.
I'm sniffing, you know, whatever. But
yeah.
Yeah. Because you recently got married.
Yes.
By the way, your pictures you put on Instagram are fantastic. What was the wine like at the wedding?
So, for all of those people who are, you know, have planned weddings or are planning weddings, you probably know that usually there's some limitation to the wines you're serving unless you manage to work with a venue that allows you to bring in your own wines.
Yep.
So there's that. And for one, my venue did not allow me to bring my own wines. Actually, they allowed to a degree. So I actually said to them, every venue I went to, I actually straight up said to them, so if your wine list sucks, can I bring in my own stuff? And some people said yes, and some people said no. And actually, most people said no. Very few people said yes, especially if they were, you know, if they had a bar. And some people said, maybe. And I would often have to be like, look, just so you know, like, I write about wine. I have connections. Like, I know it's not an easy thing. I could connect you with the right agent. So I'm not just leaving the work in your hands. Like, I understand how markups work, all of that kind of stuff, right? So I really tried to make it easy for them. So the venue that I got married at has, I don't know if they still have it like right now because I know things change. But at the time, their relationship was with Rife. And they said, you know, specifically we had one relationship with one winery because they know they can deliver at the quantities and volumes that we needed. And then I learned at that time that Rife actually has an agency. They actually do import. I didn't know that. I know, you know, a lot of wineries do have an importing arm, like Henry of Pelham has FWM and stuff like that. But I didn't realize that Rife had that. So I had the selection of two wines at my wedding. I picked an Ontario Chardonnay. I think it was actually called Love or something like that, but it delivered.
Yep.
And then I picked a Montepulciano for a red, mm-hmm. Which is one of the wines that they imported. And the other thing is like when you pick wines for your wedding, you're thinking, who is going to sit there with a discerning palate? And who's there to just be happy to have red or white wine at a wedding?
Yes.
And how do I find, and then also knowing that you're the one paying for said wine. So are you going to be buying wines that are $60 to $100 a bottle for half of the people who don't care at all?
Then it's just an ego play.
Yeah.
And it's just stupid.
Yeah. So you're always trying to find that perfect balance.
Yeah.
And I will say, and I had a mix of non-winos at my wedding and fellow wine writers at my wedding. And as far as I know, and I hopefully, and hopefully I'm friends with most of those people enough that they aren't just being kind to me. Everyone enjoyed it.
Good. All right. I'm always curious. I'm always curious about that. I'm now going to say blind. I'd screw it up. I would go, I'd go with a Cru Beaujolais on, okay, on the wine we're drinking now. Just because there's a lot of, there was a lot of bright, fresh, I can never say the word correctly. Ebullient. I fuck it up every time. It is a real adjective, and it's just, there's certain notes I get. My brain, I know if I, because sometimes I wonder, okay, if blind, where would I go? I bet I'm gonna be calling this Beaujolais. It's still light enough on the body and the tannin where I think my brain would go with Cru Beaujolais, not Beaujolais Nouveau. Some sort of Cru Beaujolais is where I would go, and I'd be wrong.
Interesting. I can see that though. Beaujolais is one of those things that I find like enters my repertoire like a beast on occasion, right? It'll, like suddenly I'm drinking all the Beaujolais and I'm trying all the different regions, and then I just set it aside and don't drink it. And it's been a while since I've had it, and I might have maybe tried to peg it for like a Morgon or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm trying to, like, obviously I've been spoiled and I know it's Syrah. So once I know it is, I can start, my brain obviously starts finding all the little connections that it's been given. I wonder if blind, what I would have.
I do that sometimes. Like, blind, where would I go? And if I'm being honest with myself, I'm like, I think I might have called, you know, I might have called this something else. All right. I got time for only two more questions. Damn it. I wrote down a bunch of your goals for the new year. We're not going to be able to get to all of them. How good are you at being kind to yourself?
I'm horrific at being kind to myself.
Why? Life is short. You know, you've accomplished a lot and stuff. Why can't you be kind to yourself?
Because I never think I've accomplished enough.
That's tough.
It's you know, it's funny. I actually had this conversation with Eric, my partner, yesterday. I was kind of wandering around right now where we just started getting photos from our wedding, videos from our wedding, and I'm looking through them and going back and obviously asking for certain edits. And as I was watching the day, and I don't remember a lot of the day. The day was so packed. We had performances. I was performing. I had, you know, all these things going on. I don't remember most of the day because it's so crazy, right? And the adrenaline's extra high. But I remember looking at these photos, wandering around, reflecting on it. And I said, Eric, our wedding kind of sucked. I said, like, I noticed this wrong, and it wasn't what I envisioned. There's this thing, and he got upset. He actually got really frustrated. He's like, what? He was like, why? What? Like, why do you do this? Like, what? Like, what? And I was like, you know me, because you know we've known each other for a long time. I'm like, I'm a producer. I used to be a former producer, and I'm a perfectionist, and I'm always striving for something for the best, and I do struggle with sometimes just enjoying the moment. And I said, you know me. And he's like, I thought it would be different because it was our wedding. It's, you know, meant to be a beautiful, happy moment of our life. I did not expect that you would look at it like a production and pick it apart. And I said, you know, that's who I am, I guess. And I some part of me thought I wouldn't either. Some part of me thought I wouldn't, but I did. And for better or for worse, that is who I am. For better or for worse, that's why I accomplish and achieve the things I do, because I want so much out of my life. You said life is short. Yeah, life is short. And that's why I got to go at it at 500%, because I only have one life. There's so many dreams I want to accomplish and never enough time to achieve it, which on one hand, it gives me an exciting life, right? On one hand, I do a lot of cool things and I travel and I eat and I want to stuff myself full of those experiences. On the other hand, I recognize the toll it's taken on my health over the years. You know, I work less than I did a few years ago. There was a period in my life where I worked 21 hours a day. I slept 3 hours a night.
Jeez.
It was insane. I did it for a long time. And I look at pictures of myself, and I was in my 20s, and I looked older than I do now because of how hard I was on my body and how hard I was on myself. And I never thought I was good enough. Never thought I was good enough. And that's some internal shit that sometimes, you know, obviously I need to work through, and probably other people need to work through if that's how we feel. I'm learning to slow down. I'm learning to recognize that sometimes if you experience something in slowness, you get another experience that's richer, right? I think about my 16-year-old self that took the double-decker bus around England and was all about quantity, not quality. And I would race through St. Paul's Cathedral and the camera's trailing behind me because my hand's taking the photo as I'm walking, right? And being like, what if I spent 2 hours in this castle instead, like, you know, not St. Paul's Cathedral, but what if I spent 2 hours wandering the castle in Germany and going through the castle grounds? What if I sat at this cafe and sipped and just watched people? That's a different enrichment of experience. And what if you took better care of yourself so that maybe you can appreciate those things for longer to come? Because if your health goes, then you won't be able to even do any of the things that you want. And that's something I am trying so hard to prioritize. I actually put in my calendar. I'll block it off in pink. I have in pink in my calendar is when it's like, this is a leisure time. And I'll say like, take a walk. Or I'll say, you will, for these 3 hours, you will putter around your condo and maybe just like do minor housekeeping or just think about things. Because if I leave it blank, I'll just work.
Right. Last question for you. Where would you like to be with 9 ounces, please? Where would you like to be 3-4 years from now in the wine world?
Oh, I ask myself that question a lot too, and I never know the answer. So I've told you before, I don't want it to be where I dedicate all my work, because I want to, you know, the way I said this to someone, I want to still love wine at the end of it all.
I still love wine.
And do you do this? Do you do everything full time in wine? I actually don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, my main job is sports talk radio, but I do the podcast, host wine events. Yeah. And so a lot of my life is dedicated to wine. I love it as much, if not more, than when I started doing WSET courses over a decade ago.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when I left the acting world for a long time, I didn't love it. And I think I'm still working through a lot of that, because it just ground me up. It put me through a meat grinder, it spat me back out, because I compromised so much of myself in order to just make a living in the industry, and it battered me. And when I start feeling like that I need to play the game, I guess, so to say, and I can't speak my voice, or that someone's going to, or I'm going to lose out on opportunities because I'm not playing by the rules of someone else and I have to do it. Like you said, mortgage versus morals. I don't want that.
Yeah.
So I love the wine industry. I love wine and I love the industry and I love all the people I've had a chance to meet. You know, it's so amazing to connect with people with similar passions and to learn more and have people genuinely enthused about what I do, and I in turn am enthused about what they do. So I think more of that, you know, from an ambitious and aspirational standpoint, of course I would love to grow 9 ounces, please. I would love for, you know, to get, I would love the podcast to do better. I would love for more people to see my work. I would love to be able to do more in the world of wine, but I want to be able to do it sharing my true authentic voice.
That's fair. Marky, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for doing the pod.
No, thank you for having me on.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with the Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, iTunes, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.